Okay, can you all hear me okay? Yes. Great, yes. Fantastic. Now, two favours I have to ask you. If at any point you can't hear me, or if at any point I'm talking too quickly, shout out and tell me. I have a habit, especially after drinking a lot of coffee, of talking very quickly and getting very excited about our research. So thank you, Eleanor, for that kind introduction. And I'll just give you a bit of a background to our project as well. I'm hoping everyone here is here because you're interested in evolutionary science and religion in society, and not just because it's dry.
That's okay, too.
It's okay if you're sheltering from the rain, because I hope that you will engage and learn something from this process as well. And as Eleanor said, yes, we want this to be an interactive session, so we're not going to talk for too long. We're just going to tell you a little bit about some of our research, and then we'd really like to hear some of your thoughts on the subjects that we're working on, because obviously for us, this is an opportunity for us to learn as well. So we might be sitting up on a pedestal, but we don't feel like we should be. We should be sitting down in the grass with you two. Okay. So, as Eleanor said, I've been working in this field for a number of years, and I started first looking at debates around evolutionary science and religion when I was organising the Darwin anniversaries in 2009 for the British government. So I was working on the dual celebrations, so the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species, and Darwin, who was very clever, published it on his 50th year of birth, so it was also the 200th anniversary of his birth, so he got a double whammy anniversary celebration. So if you're going to publish a big book, make sure you do it on your 50th year, is my advice. The project I was running, Darwin Now, was for the British Council, so it ran in actually about 50 countries worldwide. It was a huge endeavour to communicate evolutionary science across a range of cultural contexts. Now, one of the things that we first realised when we first started running this project was that there was absolutely no information about what people think about evolutionary science outside of the US. So very little research done looking at public perceptions of evolutionary science. So I started from very little information, trying to build up a picture of how people in different countries might think about evolutionary science. Before this, I hadn't really thought about science and religion to any great extent. It just started to kind of occur to me as I went through this process of running this huge programme, working with journalists and academics from all over the world, with educators, school teachers, people who work in science communication. And every kind of so often I'd come across a conversation where people would be going, well, you know, we know in this country that people won't like evolution because, like, they're mainly Muslim in that country, or they're mainly Christian in that country. And, you know, religious people, they can't accept evolutionary science. So I just kept hearing this. And obviously this kind of didn't really ring true with my own personal experience of people I know who work in the sciences, but also people I was encountering with on a daily basis in all the countries I was working in. So I started to think, where does this kind of myth come from? Where does this idea come from that you can't accept evolutionary science and hold religious beliefs? Obviously, at the same time, I was also, as Eleanor said, writing a book about Richard Dawkins. I will confess at this point, some people here might not even know who Richard Dawkins is, because there's a few people who are possibly, thankfully, too young to have encountered him. I'm celebrating the generations who don't know who Richard Dawkins is. Richard Dawkins, for those of you who don't know who he is, was a well-known popularizer of science. He wrote a book called Selfish Gene, and then Blind Watchmaker, Ancestor's Tale, and various other books about evolutionary biology. Now, he mainly focused on kind of the then contemporary ideas of inheritance. He's probably maybe better known today for his non-science book, really, which is God Delusion. So he's a very prominent atheist who was also a very prominent popularizer of evolutionary biology. Now, obviously, these two things have tended to be conflated both in his mind and in the media and public mind as well. And he, as many of you in this room will know, is obviously one of the proponents of what is sometimes called New Atheism. So it was around this time that Richard Dawkins was still quite popular. He was someone that people kept thinking, well, if we're going to talk about Darwin, we should get Richard Dawkins to talk. And rather ironically, I had to replace him on several occasions, which was quite amusing. I'm sure it amused him less than it amused me. But the thing that was going on at this time then is you've got a huge anniversary celebrating Darwin, and you've got someone like Richard Dawkins who's really tagged evolutionary science to the notion of atheism. So it's understandable, perhaps, that especially in the UK, where he was much more influential and much more popular, this idea that you have to be an atheist to accept evolutionary science had become a kind of narrative that was seen as just normal, seen as common sense, almost. So I started to think, well, you know, the data I'm collecting and the people I'm meeting don't really uphold this idea. So thinking about why do we think that there's a link between atheism and evolutionary science, and how do we sort of unpick that? Well, there's various ways you can unpick it from a kind of philosophical, a theological or historical perspective. And the obvious one historically is obviously that Charles Darwin himself was not actually an atheist. He had vacillations, his faith wavered throughout his life, but he was never go so far as to call himself an atheist. His co-discoverer, Alfred Russel Wallace, for those of you who haven't heard of Alfred Russel Wallace, he was the person who jointly published a paper with Darwin in 1858, where the idea of evolution by natural selection is really first brought into the public domain. Wallace was actually an ardent spiritualist. There are also other examples throughout the history of evolutionary science. Another name that springs to mind is Dobzhansky, the person who famously said nothing makes sense in biology without evolution. He himself was at points a practicing Catholic. So it's really easy to kind of unpick historically that a lot of the people we might see as icons of evolutionary biology were themselves actually either people who had spiritual beliefs or religious beliefs. So you could start to unpick it that way. Obviously, the way that gets refuted is that people say, well, you know, Darwin was a man of his time. He couldn't come out and say he was an atheist. So there's always people who push back in that way. You could examine all the different discourses between theological positions and scientific positions and philosophical positions. And there are some people in this room who do an excellent job of doing that. One of the things I wanted to really get to grips with, though, is do we actually find that most of the people who accept evolutionary science are themselves atheists? I think it's a much more kind of interesting question when we think, what do real people think? What do they really do in their lives? Forget the kind of, you know, the warring intellectual gods on kind of like the kind of ivory tower kind of approach of thinking about, does this piece of scientific information fit with this theological position? Most people in their day-to-day lives don't think like that. So what we wanted to do was find out what real people thought and how they engage with these problems or not in their day-to-day lives. And surprisingly enough, no one had really actually done any of this research before then. There's been little bits of work done in the US, but as any of you know anything about the politics of evolutionary science in the US, it's a very special context, one that maybe Carissa, who is herself.
Just say something so you can see that I'm American.
Can comment on personal experience. So we need to be careful, otherwise Krista might, I'm within striking distance. It's really, really quite shocking then that a lot of these kind of debates in the public domain, so people like Richard Dawkins and others who are promoting science and good kind of, you know, sound empirical reasoning, are basing these arguments on no social scientific data. So we've gone out and we've collected some of the first large-scale social scientific data looking at what publics think across a range of beliefs. Hence the exploring the spectrum. So that's a spectrum of beliefs, including religious, spiritual but non-religious and non-religious. And I know they're very big, clunky categories, and I'm more than happy to discuss the problem of using those terms. So we look at all faiths and none in our research. And the project that we're talking about today, Science, Religion, Exploring the Spectrum, we have been running for the past 3 years research in the UK and Canada. And we've just got, well, we're wading through the data we've got there. We've got tons of data, which is not a thing we're complaining about because as researchers, that's great. But we're just about to embark on the next stage of our research, and we'll be actually looking at public perceptions of science and evolutionary science and religion in Argentina, Australia, Sri Lanka, Spain, Germany and the US. So starting to expand out to a range of different cultural contexts. Now, I'm just going to run through a little bit of some of the data we found, and then Carissa will talk through some of her data that she's been collecting from the psychology side. And then we'll kind of open up and answer any questions, think about any kind of comments or experiences you might want to share. We've also got a number of comics down here, which people can take at the end, which are free, which give some of our data in a slightly more digestible format than me sitting on a platform talking at you. So just to kind of run through then, one of the things that kind of concerned me when people were talking about the relationship between science and religion and science communication was there was this assumption that to be religious was to be a creationist, and that to be a creationist is always to reject all of evolution. I think there's a couple of problems in here. One is that sometimes people use the term creationist to describe themselves, but they don't necessarily mean that they're rejecting evolutionary science. So a fantastic example of this was in a conversation I had in Jordan. So we ran with the government in Jordan some of the first public debates around evolutionary science in Jordan with school children and publics. And we had a panel, and there was a professor of Sharia who was on the panel with us. And the next day I met with him, and we had a couple of hours to sit and chat with each other. And he said to me at the beginning of this conversation, "Well, with all due respect, I don't know what we're going to talk about because I'm a creationist and you're a Darwinist." And so I said, "Well, you know, we've got 2 hours. Why don't we talk about why we believe these things, why we think in this way?" And by the end of that conversation, he realised that actually he wasn't a creationist in the strict sense that people tend to use the term creationist, because he was entirely comfortable with the idea of a geological time, of common ancestry, of the process of evolution. He just felt that there was a god of first cause, if you will, so a deity that flipped on the switch, which is in no way controversial in terms of acceptance of evolutionary science. And in fact, you could argue it's a similar position to the position that someone like Alfred Russel Wallace himself took. So if we're going to call the co-discoverer of evolutionary theory a creationist, I think we're on slightly shaky ground. So that really kind of highlights, I think, the problem is that when we use terms like creationist, we tend to be thinking of a very particular political position that comes out of the US. So we tend to think of young earth creationism, people that believe in a divine act of creation for every species, that don't accept geological time. So think that species on this earth have only been around for somewhere in the region between 4,000 and 6,000 years. That don't accept the notion of common ancestry with other ape-like species. So that's a very, very, very narrow kind of set of concerns about evolutionary science. So there's one thing, first of all, is that there's this idea of this kind of scary monster we like to call creationism, but actually it's the way that we tend to use that term in public, in the media, in academia, in schools, is talking about one very, very small set of ideas. It doesn't actually talk about the way that people actually really kind of think about these things in their day-to-day lives. So we conducted some research in UK and Canada. We employ multiple methodologies. So we go out, we talk to people, we do semi-structured interviews, focus groups. We've got historians working with us. We've got people looking at kind of media, looking at how the BBC's represented debates over the past kind of number of decades. We've got psychologists, of which Carissa is our example. we do quantitative survey work. So we do quantitative survey work with YouGov. And in the data that I'm going to talk about a little bit now, I'm talking about some of that survey work, mainly because it's the kind of thing that I like to roll my sleeves up and get messy with the statistics with, though occasionally I might use terms in a way that irritates the psychologist. So what we found then is that in some of the previous surveys that had been done in the UK, which were very, very simple, they'd normally just be one question on evolutionary science, and it would always have some notion of, if you accept evolutionary science, it was related in some way to God belief. So it would always be a question really about that the Earth has evolved through a process of natural selection in which God has not been involved, in a way where evolution has been guided by God, or in a way where all species have been directly created by God. So it's very, very reductionist, very binary kind of approach that assumes an either-or position either you accept evolution and reject God belief, or you accept the existence of a God and you reject evolution. So it's a very polarizing question. So we sort of deconstructed that. And we also re-asked the same question as well. Now, in previous surveys in the UK, the people that would be typified or classified as creationists have come out at about somewhere between 16 or 19%, depending on which year. We actually got a lot lower in our survey. So we got about 9% of the people that we surveyed in the UK adopting that position. So much lower than previous surveys. I don't think that's necessarily because the people adopting that position are changing. I think it's actually to do with the way we designed our survey, because we asked lots of other questions about evolution and religion as well. So that might have kind of made people consider the way they're responding to that question in a slightly different way. But even that is quite interesting, because it shows that it's not something that is always a strongly held belief, I think, with some of the people who say yes to that. So one thing that I think is really important to remember, that's actually not a strongly held position across the general public. Now, when you look at people in the survey who identify as holding a religious or spiritual belief, one might think that that's going to be a significant number. But actually, in the UK, it's only about 15.7% of people who identify as religious or spiritual who say that they hold that kind of young earth kind of creationist position. There is a kind of slightly larger number that say they have some difficulty, say around 11%, in accepting evolutionary theory in relation to their beliefs. But still, not quite the kind of moral panic that people like Richard Dawkins and others might want us to have. You know, there's this scary threat from religion to science. It's not really what we're finding in our data. We did find some really quite interesting things that atheist and non-religious people were thinking, though, which was quite fun. So we asked a number of questions about why people might have concerns around evolutionary science. And the main thing that comes up is human evolution. It's mainly about where do humans come from. And that's not surprising, because we are a pretty navel-gazing species. We like thinking about ourselves. We like, you know, kind of asking questions about what makes us different. Why are we all sitting in a tent with electricity, wearing waterproofs and shoes and other bits of technology? What makes us different from other animals and species on this planet? It's a perennial question that philosophers and scientists and theologians have been tackling with for centuries. So it's part of a bigger kind of narrative, I think. Why are we here? Where are we going? What are we doing? The thing that's really interesting is that we asked questions then about different facets of human evolution. And so when we looked at the religious populations within our survey, we found that as we asked different questions about human evolution, more and more people started to kind of suggest that evolution couldn't explain some of these things. And the things that became most kind of noticeable were that a very large proportion of the religious groups that were surveyed felt that evolutionary processes weren't that good at explaining the origins of the human brain or the origins of human consciousness. And human consciousness, about nearly half of the sample who were religious or spiritual felt that evolutionary processes couldn't fully explain human consciousness. Okay, so fair enough, we might expect that. So then we looked at our non-religious sample. And really, really interestingly, in our non-religious sample, we found that about 30% of our non-religious sample felt the same, that human consciousness was a bigger question than perhaps evolutionary processes or potentially evolutionary science can currently answer. I mean, obviously, that's non-religious. Now, non-religious isn't just atheists. That's many different types of people. We should never think that non-religious groups are people who don't have any kind of spiritual beliefs. So, for example, in our non-religious group, roughly about a third of them think that there's existence of soul beyond death, which isn't something you would typically think an atheist would think. Now, we separated out. We actually asked people when they said they were non-religious. We said, OK, so what does that mean to you? So we gave people the opportunity to say, I'm a humanist, I'm a free thinker, I'm an atheist, and many other categories, agnostic obviously being one of them. So our full atheists, we had a look at them separately to see what they thought about human consciousness. And really, really, really interestingly, about one in five of the British atheists that we spoke to also said that they felt evolutionary processes might not be able to explain human consciousness. So that throws up a really, really, really stark question for us, because the assumption has always been in the public space narrative about evolution and the reasons that people might raise questions about evolution. It's always been there's evolution here and religion here, and the two will forever be warring. Right? The conflict is from between religion and science. No one's really unpicked it and start to think, well, maybe the questions that people are raising are universal questions about human existence. And if it was just about a conflict between science and religion, we wouldn't expect to find those concerns being raised by non-religious individuals or by atheists. And actually, that's what we've found. So what we're starting to see by unpicking this vast swathe of data we have is that actually some of the things that people have previously thought were conflict driven by theological or religious identities were actually things that affect all of us. So one of the things that we're really now starting to look at is more broadly, what do kind of people think about human evolution, and how do people think about us as a species being separate from other species? So that really then kind of leads me to the next big question for our research, which Carissa will talk about a little bit, is if that's the case, if these are kind of potentially more universal questions that we're all asking ourselves, why is there this narrative in the public space that evolutionary science and religion are in this perpetual form of conflict? Now, there's a kind of a historical answer to that, but there's also something about the way that we today interact with each other. And I think that's probably where I will hand over to Carissa to give us some of the psychological research that maybe gives us a little more insight into that.
Sure. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. So one of the things that we're trying to figure out in the kind of social psychology side of the research project is what are the psychological processes behind how people understand the relationship between science and religion, and then how particular narratives are perpetuated. What kind of psychological functions are those based on and might be perpetuating those kinds of narratives? So one of the things that we've looked at, and forgive me for a bit, because I'm going to kind of talk about groups of people in a way, and obviously we recognize there's a huge spectrum. You say religious, there's a huge spectrum of religious views that people have, but I'll just be talking about kind of atheists and non-religious kind of more generally, and religious people when talking about my specific research, because we found that that's a really helpful way to kind of try and look at some of the larger processes that are going on. And one of the things that we wanted to look at is, why is it that people think it's religious people who have a problem with evolutionary science and religion? When we survey people of all different faiths and none, we find that it's actually people kind of on the atheism and non-religious side of the spectrum who see science and religion as being in more conflict. And from social, the way one of the theories that we use to try and investigate this is something called social projection. So this is a theory that says that if I believe something, I'm going to think that somebody like me would think the same thing. But what we find is that when we're talking about people's perceptions of evolutionary science and religion, that it kind of breaks that pattern. So we find that across all faiths, people tend to think that religious people have a problem with reconciling evolutionary science and religion. And that this is particularly pronounced for people who are on kind of the atheist side of the spectrum. That there tends to be this idea that religious people have a hard time reconciling evolutionary science and religion. So what are some of the issues then that come up out of that kind of social projection of the way that people are thinking about how people reconcile science and religion? And one of the things that we can think about here is the implications for representation and religious diversity in science fields. So research has shown that the percentage of scientists who are religious is lower than that of the general population. And we also find this in our research that when we ask people to name atheist scientists and religious scientists that they can think of, examples that they can think of, they tend to be able to name more atheist scientists than religious scientists. So it seems that there are just fewer religious scientists that people are aware of in the public sphere. And the examples that people can think of in terms of religious scientists tend to be more historical or anecdotal. So, you know, my grandma, for example, right? So it seems that there's just, for one of the things that we find is that there's less knowledge of exemplars, as we say, examples of religious scientists in the public sphere that people are aware of. But we know that people tend to see compatibility between science and religion. People who are religious tend to see compatibility between science and religion. And when we ask people about the identities of being a scientist and or an evolutionary scientist and being religious, when we ask religious people about how those identities go together, on average we find that people think that those are compatible identities. So for people who are religious, they see being a religious scientist as being a compatible identity. For people who are atheists, we find that they tend to see those as being incompatible identities. And for them, they see being an atheist and being a scientist as being compatible identities. So this has an impact on the way that religious people feel might feel represented and accepted by scientific fields. So in academia, for example, the majority of science professors in academia tend to not be religious. This is something that we see, for example, with gender representation in science. So women in science don't tend to see the same kind of role models, and therefore they feel less kind of belonging. They feel like they don't belong in that area as much, and there's this kind of reinforcement effect that, you know, maybe this isn't the space for you. We hypothesize that there might be a similar effect for religious people in science and in evolutionary science in particular, where there's this, although people who are religious on average tend to see the identities of religious and scientist as going together, in actual practice, in the role models that they see around them and in the departments and professions that they may be interested in going into, they may not feel like they would belong and be accepted. So this is one of the areas that we're particularly interested in.
So, yeah, I'll not speak for much longer, and then you can ask us questions or tell us about your own experiences. So this is one of the things that really drives our research. It's really about this concern about two things. One, a kind of wider kind of what we might think of as an implicit bias, or at its worst, the prejudice about kind of the role of religion in society in what really is, quite frankly, a scientific and technological culture. The other facet of that is obviously that has implications when you look at it at a global level. And we also do some work that looks at science in Muslim societies, for example. And there's a lot of this kind of form of projection, especially, actually, unfortunately, in some of our work that we've done in the UK, where people go, oh, well, obviously I don't have a problem with science and religion, or we know that Christians don't have a problem with science and religion, but Muslims do. And obviously this is also unfounded, and the research data we're collecting there also shows that this is still a form of social projection. The other concern we have, obviously, is how does that play out in what we might think of as secular or scientific spaces? And being people who work in universities, we obviously ourselves are quite navel-gazing. So we think about how the diversity in our own workplace, in terms of, it's not a good thing to have a kind of monoculture, a lack of diversity around any kind of cultural identity. So it concerns us that there might be a kind of disinclination or kind of cultural or social barriers that preclude people from coming into STEM, so science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine kind of careers because of their religious or spiritual identity. So that's something that we're beginning to do much more work on. But unfortunately, the indicative work we've done to date and work we've done with other organisations suggests that this could play quite a significant role. So those are our biggest concerns, really, is how do we open up kind of diversity in STEM, both nationally and internationally? How can we tackle these kind of prejudices at a kind of social level, both in the kind of media, in education, in scholarly kind of discourse as well? And how do we kind of challenge some of those kind of rather reductionist kind of binary and polarizing kind of narratives that there's this kind of constant warfare between religious beliefs, spiritual beliefs, and acceptance of evolutionary science? So the floor is yours. Please feel free to ask anything you want or say anything you want. So this gentleman down here. That's an excellent point and question. So basically, and correct me if I'm wrong here, anecdotally, there's a lot of concern about the role that science might play in people losing their faith, so moving from religious belief to non-religion. The bigger question coming from that is, what role should organisations like our own and others here play in educational settings in terms of challenging those kind of narrow perspectives in schools or educational settings that might lead to that? So there's kind of two points here, and I think there's probably an example you might want to be able to give from some of our research data. You know which one I mean. that I think are important. Firstly, thinking about what role does science play in secularisation? That's a really big, quite thorny question. And the kind of consensus that's really forming at the moment is that science doesn't necessarily play a huge role in secularisation. In those kind of personal narratives that people tell, there's all sorts of other social, psychological, and cultural factors at play. It's just that sometimes in the testimonies that people give about why they have lost their faith, science might be part of the narrative structure that they build. So we have to be very, very careful about the role of testimony in the way that people talk about these things, which is why it's important to look at kind of social trends as well. I guess it all ties into the broader conversation about secularisation itself. Now, obviously, the secularisation thesis, for those of you who haven't come across it, is a kind of broader view that over time, as society progresses, and that obviously includes scientific progress, the world will become a less religious place. This hasn't actually happened in the way that it was predicted to happen. And actually, this is why we have to be very, very cautious about thinking that non-religion equates to no kind of what we might think of as kind of religious or spiritual beliefs, because actually that isn't the case. It's a fantastic project going on at the University of Kent that you should look at and have a look at their website. And there's a whole suite of different researchers working on it at this moment. It's a project called Understanding Unbelief, which is really starting to tease out what non-religion means in that sense. So it's important to recognise that that kind of secularisation isn't happening in the way that it was predicted. I think we also have to be really careful about tying the notion of scientific progress into social progress. because it doesn't work like that from a history of science perspective either. But that's a different conversation and probably one for another day. The point about education settings is also an important one, because actually this is where some of this prejudice plays out. So did you want to give the example of the...
Yes, I can't remember it exactly offhand, but we asked people to kind of write about their personal experiences with science and religion for a study that we did. And one of the people who took the survey was actually a science teacher who was very non-religious and said that, you know, they see telling their students that science and religion are at odds as being part of what they do in class. And so obviously that's one anecdotal piece of evidence.
It was much blunter than that, though.
It was very blunt. I'm saying it a nicer way. But you know, it is something that certainly on an individual level could certainly impact religious students who, you know, in that setting then will be confronted with that kind of attitude, and then might kind of, you know, extend that to be an indicator of, you know, all scientists or all science professions, that kind of thing.
I think it's the dual problem is, of course, is you've got people who are educated in what is predominantly a secular setting going into teaching science in the classroom who hold the same implicit biases that we're uncovering in our research, who'd originally been taught by people with that. So it's like this kind of perpetuating cycle. So in answer to the question of what should we do about it, well, actually, we're starting to pilot some work with schools, looking at ways that we can bring students into doing projects around science and religion in the social context to think about how these narratives are formed. So I think it is quite important to actually start tackling that. But I think one of the most important ways of doing that is actually thinking about teacher training rather than thinking about what's going on in the classroom. So there's a gentleman at the back first, and then this gentleman here, and then the lady over there.
I'm just wondering what role our church is going to have in this.
Oh, God, that's a bigger question, because the thing is...
Sorry to interrupt, but I may be able to answer that.
Well, go for it then, if you can answer it.
I work in a Church of England secondary school.
Yeah.
I teach religious studies, but I'm also the school chaplain, lead collective worship. And a lot of my role is to communicate to students that science and religion are not at odds. And I see that as a big part of my role. Mm.
It's
about that one around.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, and I think one of the things that's also important in all of this is it's not just about educators, it's not just about people in church organisations or religious organisations that need to take responsibility for this. I will hands up here to my own worldview, and I'm actually an atheist. And I've always been an atheist. I feel that it's fundamentally important that all of us communicate this kind of deconstruction of what is basically a prejudice at every available opportunity. And it means that we need to collectively work together. I think one of the great things to do is kind of picking up a bit on what Carissa was saying about stereotypes, is kind of to show what we might think of counter stereotypes. So different role models, different ways of engaging. So one thing I've been quite involved in doing in previous roles is looking at ways of organising interfaith dialogue that involves non-religious and atheistic organisations, so you can deconstruct that notion of a kind of an other that's in conflict. And that's important from both camps, in essence. You know, it's often people will make assumptions about people's religious or non-religious beliefs because they're not moving in those social circles with each other. And once you start to realise that these are real people who think in exactly the same way that you do, that's a really good way of deconstructing it. So the gentleman down here, and then there's a few hands at the back. So if we take a couple of questions, and then do you want to...
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to slightly knock you off beast here.
Okay.
keeping the science thing, and I know that the common thing is that the people that have been antithetical to evolutionary science have generally been the God-botherers. But I got chatting with an evolutionary evolutionary scientist and speaker at a funeral wake, bizarrely. But she had... she'd sort of done some stuff on sex difference and gender difference, and she was basically saying that the kind of things you were saying were not fashionable, in the current climate, and she was going to debates with other people on, you know, are sex differences or gender differences all socialised, coming up and saying, actually, no, there's quite a bit of research that they're not, and was getting booed. And I wondered if you saw any other areas where evolutionary science is kind of saying things that people don't want to hear or find unacceptable.
Ooh, that's, oh, crikey. And I know that there's some evolutionary biologists in this room. I'm not going to out them. and actually, having also myself studied at various points evolutionary ecology as well, I think the thing is that the way that science works is very different from the way it tends to get represented. And one thing we have to be very wary of, and this is why it's really, and this does relate to the kind of science religion debate as well, in a number of ways, we have to be really wary of this notion of what people think of as a scientific fact. Obviously, science changes over time. Because what we're working with is kind of like a knowledge of best fit. You know, at school you had to do like a graph and you've got all those dots and you have to work out where the line goes in between them, like a line of best fit. I tend to think of scientific knowledge as a bit like that. It kind of fluctuates and changes. We're roughly in the right direction, but bits of information change over time. That's why I'm very wary of using the term scientific progress, because it can sometimes abruptly change. And one of the areas I've worked quite a lot on is actually looking at theories of inheritance. And there's been quite a big shift in the way that people think about inheritance in the past 15 years, for example. So it's kind of, there are fashion trends in science. There is maverick and mainstream. And this is one of the beauties of the way that scientific endeavour works, is it's an ongoing dialogue and conversation with the data, but also with the way that we interpret it. So I think that when we think about tackling kind of debates around science and religion, it is actually really helpful to communicate the philosophy of science and how we think about uncertainty, how we think about how scientific theories might change over time, because it's not a static and dogmatic position. Equally, on the other end of the scale, I think it's really important to show that people who are engaging with theological discourses are not doing so in a static and dogmatic way either. So it's kind of both kind of perspectives need to be treated in a much more sophisticated way. And I think... Yeah, I'm sure he would, yes. So, you sort of threw me off balance. Should we take some more questions? Because I know there's lots of hands going up. So this lady down here and then gentleman there, gentleman there, gentleman here. Yeah, so should we go for a batch and then see where we end up?
I also teach RE, and one of a positive change that the government has made recently that's been made in the curriculum is that we now teach in RE much broader understanding of science and evolution, which I'm really enjoying. It's the most popular topic.
Good.
For students, and we also look at the notion of what is truth and blow their minds by looking up what is science.
It is fun blowing people's minds with the philosophy of science. I used to teach medical students philosophy of science. It was always amusing because people just go, wow, and think about the world in a completely different way. So that sounds fantastic, weren't they? So gentleman at the back, and there was another gentleman at the back, sir?
So, concerning, the discourse generally, there are so many examples in history where religion has served to sacralise science, and science has served to kind of confirm the benefits of religion. If you look at someone like Teilhard de Chardin, who thinks that God is less a kind of metaphysical string tugger from the beginning of time, but he's actually at the end of time kind of urging creation into love and connectedness, and how that is entirely compatible with evolution.
Yeah.
And that's, an example where science has kind of been sacralized by a religious thinker. And also just all the stuff coming about mindfulness, meditation, the science of psychedelic mind states, and how these can benefit the brain, religious feeling. So you kind of have a therapeutic deism going on now. What would it help to consider examples in education where science and religion are actually almost combining forces in some way? Or does that blur the boundary too much?
I might say something about the historical. Did you want to say anything about kind of from a psychology of religion perspective?
No? Well, I'll keep you talking. Start. I'll start. I might jump in.
You jump in. as someone who actually, I'm now predominantly actually a philosopher, so I'm all up for blurring boundaries wherever we can, because it leads you to interesting places. And, you know, as a philosopher, I don't need yes or no, or right or wrong. You know, I've just got, you know, philosophy. And the more questions I produce, the better I'm doing. but historically, I think you're spot on. And actually, there's a cracking book that is well worth reading by Peter Harrison, which is The Territories of Science and Religion, where he really pulls apart this idea that there's even these things that exist as separate entities of science and religion. And certainly that's one of the problems when you look at this historically, is because the blurring of those boundaries is pretty complete in places. Now, I think that there is a lot of important work being done in terms of thinking about the benefits of kind of thinking about the world in a slightly less kind of reductionist way, in a kind of more holistic way. And I think that's where there's quite a lot of work being done in psychology of religion, looking at well-being, that I think would be certainly important to communicate in a broader setting. Yes. So.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of research that's being done currently on kind of the well-being benefits of things like mindfulness, like you say, as well as looking at the relationship between religion and well-being across different cultures, and how that kind of changes depending on the wider societal kind of narrative as well. So if other people around you are religious, how does that impact the relationship between religion and well-being, that kind of thing? So it's a very complicated area, but I think you're right that kind of better kind of knowledge of that would probably be useful in terms of kind of complicating that narrative, certainly.
Okay. Yeah, so go for it.
I just wonder if that secular mindset of scientists puts them at a disadvantage of communicating and applying science sometimes. Particularly in medicine, you could think of, I've seen some research where oncologists would put religious belief at the bottom of a list of what's important for a patient in end-of-life care, but patients put it very high on their list. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would be advantageous if there was more respect of people's religious views, something to be understood to convey science and particularly medicine better.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it's all too easy, and that's why I'm concerned about things like the secularisation thesis, to forget that religious identity, religious beliefs, spiritual beliefs and identities are fundamentally important to the majority of the world's population. And when you're trained in a secular setting, you tend to forget that. I think there's another aspect to it, in certainly in terms of not just the practice of medicine, but in terms of the practice of science, is that it's all too easy to kind of allow this creeping scientism in. And you see it in the way that, say, Hawkins talks about... I always add the S. I conflate Dawkins and Hawkins. Talks about philosophy. In that philosophy is dead. Well, you know, I hope not, because otherwise I'm out of a job. But it's this notion that science can answer everything. Science cannot answer everything because of the very fundamental nature of the way that science works. Mm. And to communicate it in that way is a huge disservice to science.
Can I give another anecdote?
Yeah, no, go for it.
In that same survey, we asked people to kind of write their opinions. Somebody was taking the perspective of a scientist and saying, "Oh, I'm a scientist who's capable of answering all questions." Like, really? All questions?
So it's. I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about the stuff we're doing is we started to kind of play with this idea of the way that science can actually work as a social identity. So that people who don't work in the sciences, who aren't practicing scientists themselves, might adopt science as a worldview. It's slightly different from kind of scientism. Mm-hmm. And scientism, for those who don't know the term, is really this idea that science can answer everything. So there's no question that can't be answered by science. Obviously, we know there's quite a few questions that can't be answered by science. I think there's bigger social debates at the moment where this is fundamentally important. And obviously, one of the biggest ones is climate change. Because if we communicate science in a really dogmatic way, then it means that any uncertainty looks like fake news. So it's really, really, really important to communicate that nuance.
I just wanted to ask you a follow-up. Yeah. But you know, the BBC has been criticised for its reporting of climate change, and saying that you know they put people's opinion against you know, the scientific. You know, is that reflected in your research?
What's interesting in terms of climate change and also evolutionary biology is there's a strong support, because there's always this kind of fear mongering about public not trusting scientists and having a lack of respect for science or not valuing science in society. Actually, our research doesn't show that. What is really interesting, though, is that the two areas that publics tend to trust less are evolutionary science and climate science. And this is even more pronounced in the groups that have concerns about evolutionary science. What's really interesting, though, is those groups still have a kind of respect for people who work in biology. Genetics is more strongly endorsed than evolutionary science, even though...
It's the kind of scare words in a way, isn't it?
Evolutionary science and climate science have a cultural baggage. They have a political meaning as well as a scientific meaning, and we need to decouple that. I mean, I do have concerns about this notion of balance, because actually, in some cases, it's not really balance. You're giving voice to a minority view. And that's very problematic, and not just when it comes to communicating scientific research. That's something that I think we're seeing across the board. I agree. So there's a question down here and then another question there. Yeah.
It was really interesting to hear you talk about some of the research that's challenging the idea that the myth that religious people are kind of almost universally opposed to evolution. I think there's another kind of linked misconception that comes out of some of the other like New Atheist writers, that religious people in some way kind of ignorant of scientific kind of research and of evolutionary biology, which I think seems like a massive kind of myth, misconception. I was wondering if that's something you've looked at, or if there's kind of existing research to be done on can people be how awareness of scientific research differs.
Okay, great. So people might not have heard that at the back. So it's another myth coming out of the kind of New Atheist kind of Dawkins kind of rhetoric is that not just that religious people might reject evolutionary science, but that religious people are in some way ignorant about science and whether there's any data or research that thinks about that. Another one I'd throw into the mix there is that there's this kind of coupling of this idea of rational thinking with non-religion, atheism and science, and irrational thinking with religious belief, dare I say gender as well, anti-scientific perspectives. It's much more complicated than that, as I'm sure you're aware. I have some real concerns about some of the studies in this area, because I think methodologically they're quite weak and they use things like IQ measures, which are obviously contestable on many levels. So that's one bigger methodological concern. I think it's all part of that kind of broader narrative. You're entirely right. It's not, and this is what drove me to do this kind of work, is it's not religious people's problem that they're not engaging with science. I think that's the kind of narrative that's been drummed home by the kind of Dawkins et al. Kind of group. This is a problem with religious people. We need to eradicate religion. That's the kind of baseline narrative. The problem is that there is a lack of nuance or kind of empirical understanding of what's going on in terms of public perceptions about science, and the prejudice is coming into play. And actually what we should be doing is engaging in more dialogue with people, because if you keep telling people they're stupid or they reject something, ultimately they eventually will. Because if you're continually told that you're stupid, you're not going to respect the person shouting that at you, are you? So, those kind of interlinked narratives about kind of the claiming of rationalism, all of rational belief, which would have got some of the 18th century thinkers really, really annoyed, because, you know, the debates between empiricism and rationalism. That's another historical avenue that we probably haven't got time for. And you might fall asleep. Any other questions before we finish up? There's one more here. And this young lady here. So if you have those last two, and ladies first, apparently. Ooh, that's a really fundamentally important and great question. What do we think the solution is to getting more religious young people into science? I think this is a really fundamentally important question on many levels, and it's one that's quite difficult to answer. I think that part of the answer to that, and I think many other people in this space might have some answers to that as well, is that we need to think about education in terms of thinking about breaking down the idea in kind of schooling processes and in the classroom that you can't be religious and be a scientist. We really need to challenge that. We need to challenge that from all perspectives. We need better role models. We need better conversations about this in public. We need everyone to stand together and kind of reinforce that message. I think in kind of workplaces, so when people come into universities and go on to work in universities or non-university research, because a lot of science doesn't happen in universities. Shh, don't tell the universities. They think it all does. About 50% of scientific research in this country actually happens in industry. So we need to start challenging this in the workplace as well. It's the same with gender and science, but also definitely ethnicity and science. It's that we need to start kind of recognising this is something that everyone can do. And that's how we need to kind of talk about, you know, science more. And I think we also just need to kind of, you know, engage in better dialogue across all groups. So we should be having more of these kind of conversations. We don't often have these kind of conversations in public spaces, so we have to have more of these. So, but ultimately, like, you need to take the torch forward for us. No pressure. Cool. And then one last question, and then, sorry, Eleanor will tell me off. It'll be very quick before she tells me off. We don't look at why people have abandoned their religious commitments as much. That's the project you should look at is the Understanding and Belief Project in Kent. It's an area that not much work's been done on today, which is why it's fantastic that the work being done there is starting to happen. My view is, I think that what we'll probably find is more a kind of complex mishmash of different social factors that are happening across the board. And I think part of it is about kind of broader social issues that are happening everywhere in relation to kind of moving away from traditional models of authority and hierarchy. And that's why we need to be really careful not to say that non-religion is non-belief, because that's not necessarily the same thing. So on that note, thank you everyone. Thank you for such a lot for your audience.